Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Tech Days 2014. Please welcome Tony Krijnen.
Dankjewel. En een goedemiddag en een bijzonder hartelijk welkom op Tech Days 2014. Ik kan niet echt beschrijven hoe het voelt om hier te staan vandaag, want dat is echt een heel bijzonder gevoel. En ik denk wat het dichtst bij brengt eigenlijk is het gevoel van trots. Want ik ben met name trots op al die sprekers die vandaag uren sessies hebben voorbereid om die aan jullie te geven. Ik ben trots op de organisatie die zorgt ervoor dat alles op rolletjes draait, loopt, dat alles goed gaat. Maar voornamelijk ben ik heel erg trots op jullie, want dankzij jullie support van onze technologie en onze services kunnen wij zo'n evenement doen. Dus ik wil jullie echt heel hartelijk danken voor het feit dat jullie de tijd en de moeite investeren om deze 2 dagen bij ons te zijn en te kijken welke mogelijkheden we bieden. In de afgelopen 19 jaar dat ik voor Microsoft werk, heb ik eigenlijk in alle rollen en alle functies en alle dingen die ik gedaan heb, eigenlijk maar 1 ding gezien wat altijd hetzelfde is gebleven. En dat is verandering. Continu die verandering, nieuwe mogelijkheden, nieuwe klanten, nieuwe concurrenten. Hoe ga je daarmee om? Wat doe je daarmee? Een van de dingen waar we natuurlijk bij Microsoft ook heel erg druk mee bezig zijn is Office 365. En voor degene die het nog niet wist, ik ben ook overgegaan naar een nieuwe rol. Alles gaat naar de cloud, dus ook Tony, want Tony zit voortaan bij Office 365. Ook Daniel heeft tegenwoordig een nieuwe rol. En dan is de vraag natuurlijk, oké, wie worden de nieuwe Tony en Daniel? Komt er een opvolger? En het antwoord is ja, die komt er. Daar wordt nog druk aan gewerkt en verwacht daar een deze dagen een aankondiging over wie ons in onze voetsporen zal treden daarin. Oké. Goed, een van de andere belangrijke veranderingen natuurlijk die we heel erg allemaal voelen, waar we allemaal mee kijken van hoe we daarmee om moeten gaan, is cloud. So with that I'll switch to English and announce you that I'm very proud of another great thing we have today. We have the very best cloud speaker with us today, all the way over from Redmond. Please welcome Mr. Jeff Woolsey from Cloud Enterprise.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Bill.
Alsjeblieft.
Good morning, everyone. How are you? It's truly a pleasure to be here. Honestly, this is my second time to the Netherlands. Just love it out here. It is truly an honor and a pleasure. Thank you very much. I'm a principal program manager in the Cloud and Enterprise division. I've had the pleasure of working on virtualization, hypervisors, for over 17 years. 11 of it here at Microsoft. Before then, I was working at a small startup in California. I'm amazed by the change that I've seen throughout my career. I remember virtualization literally when it was a science project, when we were doing it and people said, that's kind of cool, kind of interesting. And now I look at where we are and how we're consuming cloud resources faster than ever. And virtualization is powering that. It's a component of it. But we're doing more, and technology is taking us to new places, to new heights. And one of the interesting things is listening to you. I spent a lot of time talking with customers, whether it's in Microsoft at our briefing center, whether it's taking these trips and meeting with you personally. And one of the first things I just want to say is, dankjewel. Thank you so very much. We very much appreciate your input, your feedback, you telling us, really, honestly and candidly, what are the challenges you're having? Whether you're a system administrator in the trenches today, dealing with, oh my goodness, I need more storage, I need more networking, I need to manage this, I'm having an app failure, I'm having a service problem, how do I scale this out, how do I scale this up? You're the CIO, you're the CTO, and you're basically saying, look, for the longest time, I've been trying to figure out, how do I take my company to the next level? I'm asking my folks to do more, sometimes doing it with less. Oh, and by the way, I want it done even faster. We hear you very loudly and clearly. And that is what we think about every day. And when I get up, how do we make sure we're delivering you the services and that ability to do exactly that? So we've got a lot of things we're going to be talking about today. We've certainly got things, I'm sure you've heard, we have a new CEO, Satya Nadella. Tremendous, tremendous guy. He's been focusing our company on mobility and cloud. Guess what? We're going to be talking a little bit about both of those. Now, one of the things I got to say up front is quite literally I could pick one section here and spend the rest of the day talking about it. I'm only going to be able to scratch the surface. But that's what this Tech Days is for. There's sessions, there are fantastic sessions all week. Office 365, mobility, cloud, you name it, and much, much more. So please take advantage of that. We'll kind of do some of the highlights here, starting with some of the industry trends we're seeing. Some of those IT pressures we're seeing, honestly, it's really interesting to watch some of these. Some of these we've seen kind of gestating. Some of these just continue to be trials and tribulations every day. Like literally, people want to bring in all sorts of devices from home and be able to bring it in the office and just expect it to work. And you know what? You have to be IT pros, system administrators. You've got to kind of balance the line there. You know what? I want to be the nice guy, and I want them to be able to be productive on whatever device they're most able to be productive on. At the same time, I've got to safeguard the company, too. I'm kind of the gatekeeper here. I can't have them bringing in any random device, hooking it up in any random way. Who knows what could inadvertently leak out the side door? Maybe I'm not worried about anything malicious happening, but I am worried about inadvertent data leakage. So devices, 52% of information workers across 17 countries report multiple devices. Apps, 25% of external app implementation spending is on mobility, cloud, and analytics. Big data. Big data is so here. 40 zettabytes. Had to look that one up. The size of the digital universe by 2020. And to me, the most interesting part is they're expecting 90% of that to be unstructured. That's the bigger challenge. But yeah, we're talking about consuming more data than ever. And how do you wade through all of that data to provide meaningful analytics? Cloud. 45% of total IT spend will be cloud-related by 2020. Our own CTO, Kevin Turner, he predicted that by 2020, he was saying $500 billion spend on cloud. Honestly, I look at that and go, I'm thinking that's a little low right now. Because cloud is growing at tremendous, tremendous rate. So, moving forward, when we think about these devices, these apps, this big data, this cloud, the way we want to provide a solution for that is through our Microsoft Cloud OS vision. At a high level, it's a unified platform for modern business. I'll explain this much deeper in just a moment. But how do we think about this? We think of this as enterprise grade. Hybrid by design. I get this question asked all the time. Jeff, in 10 years, are we going to be all private cloud or are we going to be all public cloud? And the answer is yes. Okay? I look at it as a slider. Okay? Sure, there will be some folks that are all private. There will be some that are all public. But guess what? Most people are going to be in the middle. The vast majority. And it's really a slider. And guess what? That slider may move over time for a variety of different reasons. People focused. We are very, very much focused on empowering people-centric IT. So with the Microsoft Cloud OS, it is about enabling and empowering people-centric IT, enabling modern business apps, unlocking insights on any data, and transforming the data center. And again, quite literally, we could spend all day on any one of these. There's going to be a lot of content this week that's going to dive into this further. One thing I do want to point out, though, from empowering people-centric IT, a couple things to think about. Because this is something that comes up over and over again. There is this, Jeff, I really want to let people bring whatever their device in. And we want to give them the freedom to do what they're most comfortable with on whatever device that might be. So we do want to enable this, but we are very, very much worried about compliance. Help us with that. We totally understand. So when we think about enabling users, delivering people access to the apps, data, and resources they need on the devices they love, absolutely. And there's a bunch of different technology that we use. Perhaps it's remoting an entire desktop. Perhaps it's remoting an application. Those are just a couple of the ways. When we think about protecting your data, there's a lot of different ways to do it. People ask me, for example, hey, are there ways, how do I handle data at rest? How do I handle data on the wire? How do we do all of that encryption? Well, guess what? We build those capabilities, we build those technologies. Classification, another key capability. People realize, you know what? Not every type of data in my business is super secret and super important. Some of this I want to be able to control, but there are some things that are very especially sensitive, and I do need people to have access to them. But you know what? Maybe there's only certain files you can access when you're on premises in my organization and you meet a certain policy. Guess what? If you want to access on your phone, great. You've got to meet this type of compliance. If you want to be able to VPN from home, be able to access this remotely, great. It's got to meet this type of policy. But we're going to give you those safeguards to be able to do that successfully. And then unifying your environment. A number of ways to do it. Probably one of the biggest, most popular ways, of course, we think of is a good example of Active Directory. We've placed Active Directory in the cloud with Azure, and oh my goodness, one of the fastest growing services on Azure. I've got some startling numbers here. But there's also consistency of experience. There's a symmetry involved. People think of cloud and they think of the ability to, oh, you know what, I want to be able to consume these resources. But then you go to different clouds and you realize, hold it, this experience is completely different depending on where I go to consume those resources. How can we help solve those problems? So we'll talk about that as well. So in terms of providing those apps, providing those apps ubiquitous environments, well, here's one great example. Office for iPad. We released this, and honestly, this has skyrocketed to the top of the store, and we're really, really thrilled with that. Let's go ahead and roll the video. One of the things you should really take note is that we're taking advantage of the iOS design language. This isn't a port. This was designed. This was written natively to take advantage of the iOS capabilities and the iOS design language. Being able to manage your charts, being able to deal with real Excel right there on your couch, you can do it. You want to be able to edit your Word documents. Take advantage of the key capabilities in PowerPoint. Actually sit back there and take advantage of highlighting. All of this, take advantage of the touch first that we brought to Office. Multiple authors editing the same document at the same time. Tracking, reviewing. All of the key capabilities that you expect, that you know and love, all part of this, and again, written to take full advantage of iOS. Take a look at that keyboard there. It's a custom keyboard control we wrote to make sure that Excel gave you a great experience on your iPad. So this has already been a huge hit. And our goal is to continue to drive that innovation further. We're listening carefully. We're listening for feedback. We're eager to do more. But this is just one example. Now, behind Office is obviously Office 365. Lots of sessions this week out there about Office 365. And all of this being powered by our Cloud OS. Now, when I think about our Cloud OS, honestly, to me, it's actually a very tangible, very specific thing. A lot of people ask me, Jeff, what does Microsoft think of cloud? Is this really just virtualization? Is it just that? No. Let me be super clear and super transparent. So when we think about the cloud, it really is, think of it as three legs to a stool. And the first leg starts with the private cloud, with Windows Server and System Center. And I bring them both up because I've been at Microsoft for 11 years. And sadly, I've seen the same mistake over and over and over again, which is people focus on the hypervisor, on the virtualization layer. And don't get me wrong, that's where I live and breathe. I love that. Okay? But guess what? At the end of the day, I don't care if I'm running SQL or SharePoint or Exchange or Dynamics or Link on a physical machine or a virtual machine. I care that it's running well. And this is where people fall over. They've drastically underinvested in systems management. And now people are coming along saying, well, if you move everything to the cloud, everything's magically better. Ooh. No, what it actually does is it puts a magnifying glass on the importance of systems management in the first place. It becomes a forcing function, because if you're going to move it to the cloud and you're writing new apps, guess what? You got to know how to diagnose them, to debug them, to do performance analysis, to do even more. So it's Windows Server and System Center. And let me be very clear, if you're running those workloads, SharePoint, Exchange, Dynamics, Link, SQL, the best way to do it is on the Microsoft hypervisor managed by System Center. And the reason why is really, really simple. It's manyfold. Number one, if you're running SQL, SharePoint, Dynamics, Exchange, Link, all of those management packs are written by those teams. They write those teams, those management packs that go into System Center. And they know best how to manage and monitor their workloads. From a testing standpoint, we test all of these end-to-end constantly. In a daily basis, just in the server division alone, we fire up about 35,000 VMs every single day. We run unit tests on them. Anything that fails, we pull them out so we can debug later. And guess what? At the end of the day, all the ones that passed, tear them down, start them up the next day. So every month, we're talking roughly 500,000 VMs are going through that process. Huge test and dev there. Now, the private cloud, if I was to describe in one word, is about control. Every so often, someone will come to me and say, Jeff, I've got a workload that has to reside in a German data center, on German soil, run by a German citizen. Are you going to argue with me? Are you going to try and tell me that I should move this up to Azure? And my answer is absolutely not. This is not a technology discussion at all. This is data sovereignty. This is regulatory. This is compliance. You need to do what makes business sense for you. So guess what? My answer is, let's go build the best private cloud together. That's Windows Server and System Center. At the same time, we are making tremendous investments in our public cloud with Azure, with Office 365, Azure Virtual Machines. And I bring those three up because we have platform as a service, software as a service, and infrastructure as a service. And if I was to describe our Microsoft public cloud in one word, it's scale. I can take an application today with my MSDN account, write an application, and guess what? Make that available in Europe. Click, make it available in Asia Pacific. Click again, oh, now it's available in North America. Now it's available in South America, and it will scale. It's elastic and will scale on demand. I'll give you a perfect example of that in just a moment with the Sochi Olympics. The third piece of the puzzle are service providers. Service providers actually give us customization and reach. There are plenty of times where someone says to me, Jeff, you know what? I would like to put something in Azure, but I would like to put it in a specific rack in a specific location where you have a key and I have a key. We just lock this thing down. Can I do that in Azure? And the answer is, unfortunately, no. We don't do anything onesie-twosies like that. With Azure, we're buying servers literally in lots of thousands at a time. So we don't scale like that. But guess what? We have the cloud OS network. We have folks, service providers, that are happy to do that, that will give you that customization and reach. So the reason why I bring this up is, depending on who you talk to, you will give a different answer for cloud. Someone will say, no, you know what? Cloud, Jeff, is over here. That's what cloud is. If you talk to Amazon, Amazon will say, well, that's not cloud. Amazon will say, no, it's running virtual machines up here. That's cloud. If you talk to Salesforce.com, Salesforce will say, no, that's not cloud. Salesforce will say, it's running SaaS applications up there. Our answer is, no, it's all cloud. It's the whole thing. And it's providing that consistent, symmetric experience across all of these. One of the interesting challenges I mentioned before was, if you go to Salesforce, you get one experience. You go to AWS, you get another experience. You go to Azure, you get a different experience. You get that really beautiful interface. Then you come back to your on-premises private cloud, and you had something different. And something we've heard from you has been, Jeff, this is really confusing. I thought the cloud was supposed to make this easier. So one of the things we've done is we've created the Windows Azure Pack. The Windows Azure pack, we've literally taken the UI of Azure, packaged it up, given it to you. Customers can now build your own private cloud on your own premises where you can control it. But guess what? It looks like Azure. You have IaaS services. You have PaaS services that you can deliver and still control on your premises. Service providers can do the same thing. This has been a huge hit. We've already released two versions of the Azure pack, and we're going to continue to add more and more capabilities. Next, when you think about the pieces that make up the Microsoft Cloud OS, obviously development is key, which is why Visual Studio, Team Foundation Services, all the work we're doing over there feeds into everything you see here. Management, System Center. And by the way, we're making huge investments in management in Intune, Advisor that run up in the cloud. Also, we're giving you the ability to manage from your private cloud into the public cloud or to service providers. Because one thing you've told us is, you know what, Jeff, I have a private cloud today that I built. And what I'd really like to use is, I'd like to use Azure as an extension of my data center. Wouldn't it be great if, you know, I could virtually knock down a wall, plug into a network, and I have infinite compute, infinite storage, infinite network, and it's all there, and I can treat it like my own and manage it as my own? Happy to do it. And guess what? That's why we've given you management pack capabilities, system center capabilities, to be able to manage that as one big data center. And logically, it looks like it's all on your premises. Data. SQL Server is huge. The 2014 hackathon launch, woo! All of the new in-memory capabilities are dropping a lot of jaws around here. The performance is staggering, the performance improvements that have gone into SQL Server hackathon. Identity. Well, Active Directory is pretty much the canonical way to do authentication in your private cloud and public cloud. And guess what? It's also one of the fastest growing services in Azure. And then virtualization. Some people try to sell virtualization as the end state or tell you that virtualization is cloud. Like I said, I love virtualization. It's what I've been doing. I love hypervisors. It's amazing stuff. It's not the end state. If someone says because you took a workload and you put it in a VM that you're cloud and you've hit the end state, they're not selling you the right thing. That's not the end state. The end state is where you all of a sudden realize that now I can elastically, dynamically grow my services on the fly, right? PaaSify my workloads, whether, again, it's running in the public in a service provider or in my own private cloud. At the end of the day, to me, the cloud is really simple. The way we think about the Microsoft Cloud OS vision, I can sum up really simply. I want to give you the cloud whenever and wherever it makes business sense for you. Today it's on-premises, great. But can you tell me with certainty that in a year or two from now, you're not going to have something up in Azure? Good chunk of you in the room probably already do. We're finding out that Azure is a hit. We have almost 60% of the Fortune 500 are already in Azure. So when people tell me, oh, the public cloud thing, we don't know if people are going there, they're already there. It's not a question of if, it's already happening. So there's tremendous things going on there. So in terms of Azure, 2013 was a huge year, just tremendous. Here's just a few of the things that we released. Traffic Manager, Autoscale, Mobile Services, Web Services, Hyper-V Recovery Manager, Multi-Factor Authentication. You can see here, yeah, it was a busy year for us. One of the interesting challenges in Azure is we're delivering features so fast that we have to hold them. We actually can't give them to you when we're ready because you'd see features lighting up pretty much every day, and we realize that you've told us you can't consume features that fast. So what we do is we end up taking these features, bundling them up, maybe waiting to the end of a quarter, and releasing them that way. Because otherwise, we would just be constantly inundating you with new features. But guess what? These features, this is what you asked for. And we're thrilled to deliver it to you. So please, keep it coming. The Azure footprint has been growing tremendously. 16 regions worldwide in 2014, with new ones coming up in Australia. We also had one recently open up in China. Usually when you say something's growing well, English saying is you'll say that it's growing like a hockey stick. This is growing more like a flagpole. In 2012, we had as much compute as the entire world did in 2000. Since then, we've doubled compute and doubled storage every 6 months. That's how fast Azure's growing. And we see no signs of any slowdown there. Some of the big numbers, and they are big. Like I said, over 57% of the Fortune 500 using Azure. Over 250,000 active websites. Over 1 million SQL databases in Azure. 300 million AD users. This is a relatively new service, and we already have over 300 million active AD users. We do over 13 billion authentications a week. A week? So, it's tremendous. For our developers, we have Visual Studio Online. We wanted to make it even easier. You want to develop for the cloud, in the cloud? It's already there waiting for you. We've tried to remove as many obstacles as possible to make it as easy to get onto the cloud as soon as possible. One perfect example of that, and a great way to have a little fun, Titanfall. Titanfall, honestly, this has been an epic launch, an epic release. Let's go ahead and roll the video.
All flight, energy adjust request.
Jumping in 3, 2, 1, mark.
One of the main reasons we built cloud computing technology for Xbox One and for the game development community is really about, you know, breaking down some of the barriers to building dedicated servers in the past, but also inspiring game developers to do more.
For us as developers, we're a pretty small studio. We don't have the money or the manpower to run literally hundreds of thousands of servers around the globe. We're using Microsoft's cloud to host all of our servers. So what that means is there's data centers all over the globe. And when you start up the game, it figures out where you are and what the best connection to which data center you have is. And it'll put you on there, and then it'll spin up a dedicated server in a server farm, basically, for you on a fast connection with, you know, fast CPUs. And it makes matchmaking really quick, and then once you're in the game, it's a really consistent experience.
It's a more even experience. There's no host advantage. There's no, you know, kind of worry about who's hosting what, and, you know, do we have to now reserve performance on everybody's machines? We can maximize what we're doing, knowing full well that on the back end, we have the power there to take advantage of the game.
One of the things we're seeing that's really amazing about Titanfall is the idea that a lot of the AI and the non-player character is actually powered by the server. So they have this ability to adapt over time, change and tweak the game even after the discs have shipped without sort of interrupting user gameplay or, you know, making users download big patches or things of that nature. Really sort of delivering games as a service and making Titanfall more alive over time and custom for their users.
Knowing we have a powerful server available for anyone who plays the game means we can design it to have a couple dozen AI running around. That would not be feasible to do on a game that's client hosted. They really make it feel like a much more living, breathing world than a static, you know, multiplayer environment.
Prior to Titanfall beta, we had a really challenging time explaining to end users what the value of the cloud was. And post-beta, what we found is through various Reddit posts and online forums, we've discovered that users really get why the cloud is making the game better. They see better connection times. They see the smoothness and the fluidity of the game, the magic of the large multiplayer experience. So for the first time, I think users are seeing why server technology is really going to make next-generation gaming that much better.
I love it when the developer says, look, we don't have the manpower or the time or the money to spin up hundreds of thousands of servers. And that's what exactly kind of puts the pin on the point here, which is they should be focused on delivering the best experience, delivering the best solution. And that's exactly what they're doing. The cloud is doing all the heavy lifting, and the lifting is tremendous. Over 100,000 virtual machines in Azure are hosting the Titanfall backend. And guess what? Again, this elastically grows and scales over time. So this is a proof point. And honestly, someone said to me once, well, that's not mission critical. I said, are you kidding me? Do you know what happens if people can't play their games? People get very upset about that. This is very mission critical out there. Please, do not underestimate how mission critical Titanfall is. So speaking of mission critical, anyone watch the Olympics? Anyone? So I have to say it was huge in my house. I've got two young daughters. My youngest one, Olivia, she's a gymnast. The girls could not get to the TV fast enough after school to watch it. It was huge. We had a tremendous time. Loved it. I think I've learned something about folks here. Speed skating. I read somewhere that people are born here and skates are put on pretty much right after you walk, and many world records were set here. Tremendous. We were watching this, and I actually have family that lives here in Amsterdam, and yeah, we were getting email from them. They were very, very proud. This is pretty amazing. The thing that was truly humbling for me was because I knew secretly we were actually hosting all of this. The Sochi 2014 Olympics were delivered on Azure and Hyper-V. We delivered live encoding, video streaming to web, to mobile, to over 100 million viewers in 22 countries and 4 continents. Over 100 terabytes of storage, more than 6,000 hours of high-definition content. Over 500 billion storage transactions. And by the way, while we were doing all this, we set a world record. Turns out when the USA-Canadian hockey team was playing, that was the most live folks watching a sports event streamed live ever, with over 2.1 million people doing that. And this was powered worldwide by Azure. This, to me, is one of my favorite quotes of all time. NBC bets about $1 billion on the Olympics. They have 17 days to recoup that investment. 17 days. Azure played a critical role. These are the largest digital events that any company pulls off, and we are really happy we partner with Microsoft. That's directly from Rick Cordella, Senior Vice President and General Manager of NBC Sports. So we are thrilled by this. We really are. It was really an honor and a pleasure to do it, and we would love and can't wait to do it again. So I talked a little bit about the public cloud. Now let's get to the private cloud. I mentioned to you that we've taken the learnings in the public cloud in terms of infrastructure as a service, platform as a service. We packaged up that UI to give you that consistency and symmetry. We're actually delivering it to you so that you can run it yourself in your own private cloud in the Windows Azure pack. So rather than talk about it, let's actually jump right into it. So first of all, the thing I want to point out right off the bat is I know you think you're looking at Azure. This is not Azure. This is the Azure pack. And yes, I know it can be confusing. I've had a lot of people tell me, Jeff, I thought you were going to do the Azure pack demo. I thought, and you ended up doing Azure. I'm like, no, they actually look so close that a lot of people don't realize it. What you see here is, number one, you can see I'm logged into AzurePack.com. You can see here that I've got websites, I've got virtual machines, I've got network, service bus, SQL Server databases, and more. So let's take a look real quickly. Let's go in here and let's take a look. For example, let's create a new from the gallery. Let's see what we have here. Well, look what we have here. We've got a variety of things sitting here in the gallery. CentOS, Linux. I got a domain controller. I've got Exchange, Link, Oracle, you say. Yes. SharePoint, SQL Server, web servers. Now, these are gallery images that I've populated in the gallery. Think about it. I can populate these with my own services so that people can log into here and self-service say, you know what, I want to check out a web server. I want to check out a SQL server. And in fact, let's go ahead and do that. Let's check out a SQL Server 2014. And in fact, this one we want to make, we want part of our domain. So let me give it a name. Let's go ahead and take a look at the sizes. You notice that we actually made these the same size as our Azure offerings. We did this again to provide us consistency and symmetry there. I'm going to go ahead and give myself a quick name and password. I know, exciting watching me type in passwords. Notice that you can give the names a pattern because I want to be able to spin these up and spin these down. I want to be able to scale out my workloads on the fly. So to do that, it's got this consistent naming pattern. So as it adds more, guess what? It'll automatically rename these for me. I'm going to go ahead and put this on my Contoso network. And folks, just like that, all I have to do now is type in my domain name, my credentials, and just like that, I've created a SQL instance in an IaaS configuration. All right? Now keep that in mind, because that's really cool if I really want to be able to control the horizontal and the vertical. I want to be able to actually go into the operating system and tweak the operating system. Some developers may want to do that. At the same time, if you're doing IaaS, it means you have to manage the operating system, you have to do your self-care and feeding. Wouldn't it be great if we gave you PaaS so you don't have to do any of that stuff? Well, we do give you PaaS. In fact, I want a SQL Server database. Let's go in here and let's create a new database. Well, let's just call this, Jeff's database. Whoops, I already gave up my game, did one of those. Give it a name. Just like that, I've created a SQL database. Now, from the user perspective, this is a PaaS service. I don't deal with having to manage the underlying operating system. And in fact, when I want to actually access it, I'm going to click on here, View Info. That's how I access it. There's my server name. There's my connection string. Now I tell my developers, or in fact, my developer can come to this portal, create this SQL database and this database instance, and now party on. And he doesn't have to worry about managing the underlying operating system, patches, backing up, and all of that stuff, because this is delivered as a PaaS service. Finally, one of the other things I want to point out is from a scaling standpoint, one of the things that people really like about Azure is this thing called auto-scale. And what happens is here, I've got Contoso Web. And my current web instances right now is I have three web instances. But what I really would like to be able to do is, wouldn't it be great if I realize, you know what, I set this too small. Business is up, more people are actually accessing this website. You know what, I could change this to 4 cores, click apply, and on the fly, it will automatically auto-scale these virtual machines. But more importantly, you know what, I don't really want to do that. What I really want to do is I want to scale it out. Because you know what, I'd like to go out to 5 instances. And guess what? Click on save, and it'll automatically add more instances on the fly. So we're giving you not only IaaS, but we're giving you PaaS capabilities. And our commitment with the Azure Pack is over time, we're going to simply add more features and capabilities. One of the things I like to remind people is when we first released Azure years ago, there were only a couple services up here. There was only, you know, a few there. Over time, Azure has grown so much that this left-hand side now is so long that we have a scroll bar here because we're constantly adding new services. Well, our commitment to you is we want to give you more of those services on-premises. So as we iterate the Azure Pack, guess what? You're going to see more features just light up here. And like I said, this is already our second iteration of the Azure Pack. So tremendous amount of things going on in terms of delivering you that easy-to-use tenant portal, that easy-to-use admin portal, the ability to create offers. So maybe you want to create a small website. Maybe you want to create a medium, a large, an extra large. You create these as templates, and instead of your user saying, hey, I need a website, you say, hey, go to the portal and check out what you need. It's all sitting there. It's all waiting for you. We have standardized offerings. And we have them, again, as IaaS VMs, or I can deliver you as a PaaS service like SQL. So Azure Pack, something super, super hot. I know there's a number of sessions this week. Please make sure you check those out. Another area we've been very focused on is virtualizing mission-critical workloads. Because we understand that as we move to put everything into the cloud, it means we have to be able to run everything in the cloud. In 2012 and 2012 R2, quite honestly, we redefined the performance and scale of the virtualization layer. And while the other guys are just starting to catch up to what we did a few years ago, we still offer some of the largest numbers in the industry. We support up to 320 logical processors on a single server. To put that in context, that's a 16-socket server. Each socket has 10 cores, and then you enable symmetric multithreading. It's a huge, huge box. We support up to 4 terabytes of physical memory, up to 2,048 virtual procs per host, up to 64 virtual procs per VM, up to a terabyte of memory per VM. And then the biggest one are the last two numbers. We support up to 64 nodes and 8,000 virtual machines in a cluster. And I've had a number of people ask me, Jeff, why are those numbers so huge? Reasons are real simple. You asked for it. We had enterprises and service providers saying, Jeff, we want to build our private cloud in a really big scale-out distributed architecture. So give us as many nodes as possible. The reason why that's so important is because we want to be able to disperse the nodes as much as possible. That's exactly why we did it. And in fact, you may note that between 2012 and 2012R2, the numbers didn't change. I had a number of people ask me why, and the answer was because after 2012, I have yet to have someone say, those are too small. With 64 procs, a terabyte of memory, and the I/O performance we can deliver over 1.6 million IOPS out of a single virtual machine. We can easily virtualize over 99% of the world's SQL Server. That's how confident we are. We spent a lot of time focusing on this. SQL is actually where we started. Went to the SQL team and said, guys, we want to build you absolute nirvana. You tell us what you need. And they were like, what do you mean? I said, you tell us what you need in terms of compute performance, storage performance, IOPS performance, networking performance. You tell us exactly what you need. They gave us their laundry list. They said, this is what we're looking for. And we said, great. We then proceeded to exceed all of those numbers. They were so thrilled. They came back and they said, oh my gosh, this is phenomenal. We have never seen this type of performance ever on any hypervisor, bar none. So that's why you talk to the SQL team and they will tell you by far and away, oh no, you virtualize this on Hyper-V. Exchange team, we ran some major tests on Exchange. We ran over 48,000 users on a single Hyper-V host. Now let me be very clear. Exchange is a scale-out application. The last thing I'm telling you is to go put all your mailboxes on a single server. Okay? The reason I wanted to do this was to point out the scalability though. We were able to run 48,000 users and still meet Exchange's extremely stringent performance requirements. SharePoint, delivering over 2 million concurrent heavy users across VMs on a single Hyper-V host. So this is some of the work that we've been doing, of course, with our own workloads, but we've also been spending time in the industry, for example, with our friends over at SAP. SAP, honestly, this one to me is amazing because we were working with SAP during development. And we were they were running their own benchmarks, and we actually got an email from them that basically said, look, we're running our standard SAP benchmarks, and we have never seen this type of performance on any hypervisor. And I said, yes, and your point is? And they said, we just wanted to verify that, because after we finished shipping, we released the RTM bits, they posted their own results. They did this all on their own. And the thing that I like to point out, this wasn't on some crazy scale-up, 16-socket server. This was on two-socket servers, industry-standard servers that everyone in this room is using. Okay, this is a three-tier, two-socket using standard two-socket servers, and was over 30% faster than the other guys. And that's publicly available as well. So we've spent a lot of time looking at mission-critical workloads. Another area is storage. One of the most common questions I hear when I talk about the three clouds and how we think about public, private, and service providers is people say, Jeff, Azure, what are you guys using for storage up there? Who's your SAN vendor? And the answer is we don't use SANs. SANs don't give us the performance and price requirements we need. If we're giving you gigabytes and terabytes and crazy amounts of storage for pennies, we can't do this on gold-plated SANs. The economics just don't work out. We've actually spent a lot of time focused on storage, on lowering storage costs, making it easier to manage. And it starts with something we delivered in terms of storage virtualization. Storage virtualization we do via storage spaces. Storage spaces basically allows you to aggregate physical disks in the pools and to present those spaces. They can be striped, mirrored, use parity. Then you add the magic of SSD. You add storage tiering, where you can basically take the hot blocks, move it in the SSD, leave the cold blocks residing on your spinning rest, and take advantage of that massive performance. And let's be very, very clear. SSD is reshaping the industry. Right now, you're seeing some tremendous amount of consolidation and change going on in the storage industry because fundamentally, storage has been locked in the same type of model since the late 50s. If you look back in the late 50s, you'll see the very first hard disks ever invented. And the platters were literally, you know, bigger than your biggest pizzas out there. And the read-write head was literally as big as my arm to go across, and seek time was measured in seconds. But between the late 50s and the early part of this century, guess what? Disks have gotten faster, they've gotten smaller, they've gotten more efficient, we put more read-write heads on them, but we were still limited by the fact that a little head had to write across the platter. And so IOPS, even on a 15K SAS drive, gets you between 150 to 200 IOPS. Well, the SSD you have in your laptop, that entry-level SSD, gets you 25,000 IOPS. Mainstream desktop SSDs now, easily over 50,000 IOPS. Enterprise SSDs even faster. It's dramatically and drastically changing the industry. So we put storage tiering as a key capability right into this technology. And then to top it off, the scale-out file server. Scale-out file server gives us a fault-tolerant solution for storage to front all of the storage that's being presented through storage virtualization. One of the little pieces of magic that brings all of this together is SMB. Now, if you've ever used SMB before, and you've used it in the past, you may think, well, SMB, isn't that kind of slow? Yeah, SMB 1, well, it was dog slow. It was also written 2 decades ago. SMB 2, yeah, it got better, but it really never was a speed demon. SMB 3 is where all of this changed. SMB 3 is a speed demon. SMB 3 is optimized for multi-channel. It's optimized to take advantage of things like SMB Direct, where we actually take advantage of remote direct memory access. So we can now push more data than you've ever seen. It's flexible. It's high performance. It's easy. You don't have to deal with zoning. You don't have to deal with masking. You don't have to deal with fiber channel cables. You don't have to deal with fiber channel switches. You don't have to deal with fiber channel HPAs. It's Ethernet. If you know how to set up a file server, you know how to set up the scale-out file server. And guess what? It works great with Hyper-V, and it works with SQL Server. And in fact, again, let me show you. So one of the things I want to do to show off, first of all, the performance of SMB3 itself is to show you a comparison of direct attached storage versus remote file storage on the Windows file server. And what's amazing is literally storage that's plugged into the server and available via SMB3, it's about the same. That's how awesome SMB3 is. We're doing amazing things to allow to deliver you remote storage on par with local storage. Now that was awesome. That's what we delivered in 2012. In R2, guess what? We then took that same configuration, enabled SSD with auto tiering, and now look at the performance. You're talking a 16x performance improvement just by adding two SSDs. Who wouldn't want that type of performance capability? Simply part and parcel, simply built in to Server 2012 R2. So I get the question asked all the time after I show that demo, Jeff, hold it. What's the hardware? Can I go buy some of this right now? Let me show you exactly what that deployment looks like. First of all, here's your Hyper-V nodes. I made this pretty modest. Here's a 5-node Hyper-V compute. It's attached via Ethernet, via SMB3. That's fault tolerant, that's multi-channel, that's auto-scaling, encryption if you'd like. If you'd like to do encryption over the wire, you can do that. And RDMA as well. You then attach this to your scale-out file server. Again, this is over Ethernet. And I got very specific here. I'm using Dell R720s. And I've got two of these because they're clustered. Because if one of those goes down, that's okay. The other one continues right along without any loss. It's not highly available. It's fault-tolerant, which means you don't rewrite your applications. No, SMB is so smart, it reroutes the traffic automatically, transparently, without you having to do anything. Then you plug that into your Dell MD-1220s. This gives you block storage. By the way, these are literally just racks of disks. These are JBOD. This is all attached via those. The file server is attached to the block storage via SAS. Now, the beauty of this architecture is really cool. Because you may go look at this and go, wow, this is great. But Jeff, what happens if I outgrow this? Well, that's the beauty of this architecture. Say you need more virtual machines. Well, guess what? You scale out. You add a couple more servers. Well, this is great. Now I've added more servers. This is more great. And you know what? Now I need some more storage, though. Okay, guess what? We can scale that out. And guess what? It's independent. The beauty of this is you can scale out the storage. You can scale out the compute. You can scale out the file server all independently. You're not locked into, oh, I have to do this in chunks at a time. By the way, if I want to do more compute, let's add some more. Oh, I need some more storage? Let's add some more. Oh, and by the way, I can even scale out the file server head. One other thing to point out is because the scale out file server are two, you know, they have their own compute and memory, that allows us to do some really awesome things. Anybody want deduplication? I do. Anybody want to take advantage of the fact that there's memory in there so I can do some intelligent caching? Oh, I do. This gives me a lot of capabilities that I can do in the file server in terms of performance, optimization, scaling, deduplication, and other intelligence. So that's a great way to do it with Hyper-V and our scale-out file server. Now, from a networking standpoint, you know, I talked to a lot of customers, and I kind of summed up one of the questions I hear pretty regularly into this. Jeff, software-defined networking is a hot topic. All the discussion is technical and really not answering the fundamental question, which is, why should I care? Honestly, everyone walked in. I just spoke to the sales guy. He tells me, look, software-defined networking is going to change my way of life. My kids will be happier. My car will get better gas mileage. My hair will grow more thick and lustrous than ever. Why would I not do this? Sounds pretty cool. Well, you know what? I agree with that. Because very often, I'm in those rooms with engineers, and you talk about software-defined networking, and their answer is RFC this, VXLAN this, NVGRE. They're not explaining the important thing, which is why. And let me explain that to you very succinctly. It's about taking your network to the cloud. Say, for example, today, you've got applications running in your private cloud. And that's cool. But you realize, you know what? I'd like to move some of those up to Azure. Or you know what? I'd like to move those to a service provider. Or you know what? Maybe I'd like to move those to Azure from a service provider or back. See, there's a very important point here. Look at those arrows. Those arrows go both ways. One of the biggest concerns I've heard about is lock-in. Everyone says, look, if I go with a cloud provider, am I locked in? You are with other vendors. Our goal is real simple. I'm going to say it again. I want you to be able to run the cloud whenever and wherever it makes business sense. Today it may be on the private cloud. Tomorrow you may move it up to our public cloud. Guess what? If you need to move it back, that's cool. We can do that too. I spoke with two Australian companies, and they basically told me the same story, which is, guess what? They were doing some development in AWS. And their CTO came to them and said, look, the government is looking at where this data resides right now. And there's a chance that they may require, they may write a law that says, we can't run it there. We need to host some of this specific data in our data centers. How do we do that with AWS? And the answer was, well, AWS didn't care about this. AWS, that's what they care about. And the answer was, well, then we're not doing that. Because we can't take that risk. We need to be able to bring it back if we need to. So that's what a key part of network virtualization, software-defined networking, is all about. Virtual networks are key to what we do. And one of the things I want to highlight is openness. We're using open standards. This is not Microsoft proprietary in any way, shape, or form. It's open. It's extensible. It's standards-based is what we're doing. And again, it's about taking your network to the cloud. It gives you at-scale management on shared physical networks. One of the biggest challenges is VLANs. People tell me they manage VLANs. How? With spreadsheets. VLAN 5 is the staging network. VLAN 7 is this network. VLAN 12 is this. Or cloud providers who literally just dole out VLANs to every customer. Then they later run into the problems that VLANs has a finite number. With network virtualization, we have over 16 million networks available. So if that's not enough, you got bigger problems. It also enables some really cool new capabilities, like the ability to live migrate across physical subnets. By definition, traversing a subnet means you lose connection, not with network virtualization. It breaks VLAN scalability limits. Also big in 2012 R2 is we include a multi-tenant gateway now in the box to translate from network virtualization to your physical fabric. Previously, we basically said we partner with a bunch of hardware partners, F5, Cisco, Huawei, and more. And a bunch of folks said that was great. But a number of you said, you know what? I really wish you just put some of this capability in the box so I could just set this up, say, for example, in a VM. Guess what? That's what we did. Multi-tenant edge gateway in the box. And then finally, from a networking standpoint, we've also been focused on delivering standards-based open management for your top-of-rack switches. So OMI. OMI, open standards. In fact, we just released a new version last week before I got on the plane out here. I think it's 1.0.8. But what this means is we're working with switch vendors out there, Cisco, Arista, for example. And guess what? From System Center, I can manage my top-of-rack switches. In fact, from System Center, I could roll in literally a rack of servers with nothing on them, completely blank. From my System Center console, I could provision all of the fabric, all of the Hyper-V servers. I could provision the scale-out file server. I could then provision virtual networks. I could provision my logical networks. I can provision my top-of-rack switches without ever leaving my System Center console. A lot of people don't even realize we have all this capability in there. That's how rich it is. And part of the reason why is, honestly, we've been moving so fast. Between 2012 and 2012 R2 was a year. And a lot of people are going, oh my goodness, that's amazing how much capabilities you've delivered. And so it's incumbent upon us to make sure you know, folks, there's a rich set of capabilities at your fingertips. Virtual networking is a key example of that. Another one of your favorite topics, live migration. Live migration is awesome. And in 2012, one of the things we focused on, quite honestly, was we wanted to provide complete VM mobility. Whether it was live migration, whether it was live storage migration, we were also the first hypervisor to deliver shared nothing live migration, where you literally have two servers, no SANs, no clusters, no shared storage, literally nothing but an Ethernet cable, and you can live migrate VMs between those. It's really, really awesome. And we did a tremendous amount of work there, but another thing we also wanted to do was we wanted to dramatically up the scale on live migration. So for example, one of the things that we realized is, look, folks have a variety of different networking connectivity available to them, and maybe you've got gigabit Ethernet. If you've got gigabit Ethernet, maybe I can live migrate 2 to 4 at a time. If I've got dual gigabit, maybe I can live migrate, I don't know, 4 to 8 at a time. If I've got 10 gigabit NICs, maybe I can live migrate 10 to 20 VMs at a time. If I've got dual 10 gigabit NICs, maybe I can do, I don't know, say 20 to 40 at a time. And in fact, what you'll see right here is exactly that. This is two 10 gigabit NICs on servers. We are live migrating 40 virtual machines simultaneously. We delivered this, again, 2 releases ago. A lot of people don't even realize it's in there. That's how incredibly powerful this is. So what this allows us to do is drain nodes even faster. But more importantly, it allows us to scale with your hardware. Because guess what? This is 2 10-gigabit NICs. We've actually done this with 4 10-gigabit NICs. And guess what? We can live migrate 200 VMs simultaneously. So there's no limit in Hyper-V. The only limit is how much hardware you want to bring to the party. So after we did this, I went back to the team and I said, guys, this is awesome. This is really amazing. How are we going to top this? And they said, you know what, Jeff, we got some ideas. So with that, let me switch on over here, because one thing I want to point out is, like I said, we made some tremendous advancements in 2012. But in 2012 R2, what we really wanted to do was up this next level. So in this next demo, I've got a virtual machine. And in all three of these scenarios, the VM is exactly the same. It has 8 gigabytes of memory, and it's running a SQL Server OLTP workload. And the reason why I'm pointing this out is this is the worst possible scenario for live migration or vMotion or whatever you want to call it. But basically, what's going on in here is the memory is constantly churning. So this is the worst possible scenario you can have. So this verse one, I'm doing between two servers running Windows Server 2012. Now, in Windows Server 2012 R2, we introduced a new type of live migration. Live migration with compression. And the reason why is this. When you buy a server these days, we have an abundance of compute. We have cores everywhere. We've got symmetric multi-threads. We've got plenty of compute. So what we decided to do was, look, let's take a little bit of that compute. And during the live migration, let's compress the virtual machine in line during the live migration. And the results are astounding. On average, you know, you'll see about a 2x performance improvement. In many cases, if the VM isn't very busy, it can be much, much higher than that. In fact, you can see that this one's already done, and the first one is still going along. Now, this is really awesome, and in fact, this is the new default in 2012 R2, because it works on any server. However, the guys said, you know what, Jeff, we actually have one more thing we want to show you. We want to take advantage of the RDMA technology that we're using in the file server, and we're going to bring that to live migration. So this third one is Windows Server 2012 R2 with RDMA, and you can see it's already done. This is crazy fast. Now, the reason why this isn't the default is because this does require specific hardware. You have to have NICs that support RDMA. But guess what? More and more of those are coming to market. And guess what? Every customer that I've talked to that's using this in production, they cannot believe it. The performance is so fast. And why? Well, let me give you a real-world example. Say you need to patch a cluster. And that cluster is an 8-node cluster. And in each node, you have 256 gigs of memory. The reason why I chose 256 gigs, by the way, is it's kind of the sweet spot these days. Most hosts we see are kind of in that ballpark range. So, again, under worst-case scenarios, where you've got a whole bunch of VMs on all of these servers, and they're flat out totally doing, you know, they're memory bound, how would I patch these clusters? Well, you would live migrate all the VMs off the first node, you put it into maintenance mode, you patch it, you reboot it, you change out the memory, add some more storage, do whatever you want to do to it, you bring it back up, you live migrate those VMs back, then you go to node two, and then you rinse and repeat as you walk through every node in the cluster. And by the way, this is true for every virtualization platform out there. By the way, if this is Windows and this is Hyper-V, this is fully automated, by the way. You don't actually have to do any of this. It's called cluster-aware automation. You basically say, hey, by the way, go patch the cluster, and there's a big go patch the cluster now button. And you sit back and you watch it go and do all of its magic. You can even schedule it and say, hey, you know what, I want this to patch my cluster last Friday of the month. It'll do it automatically for you. Well, the thing is, even if it's automated, you're still going to have somebody sitting there. Or someone's going to be still watching at the server. Maybe he's doing email off to the side, or he's doing other things, but he's still going to be watching it. Well, the reason why this is important, again, in this worst-case scenario, is because with Server 2012, it would take you about 8 hours to patch the cluster. It's a full business day. With compression, 4 hours. With RDMA, you do it over your lunch break. Very tangible benefits. That's a single 8-node cluster. If you're an enterprise, you're a service provider, and you've got, say, 20 of these, 50 of these, oh, the performance, the time alone, operationally, is huge. Finally, business continuance. So we've spent a lot of time looking at replication and looking at business avoidance, disaster avoidance, business continuity, business continuance. One of the things that really got us to think about it was Hurricane Katrina. But it's not necessarily hurricanes. It can be fires. It can be floods. It can be all sorts of things. I come from California originally. We have earthquakes. Okay, whatever it can be, something can take out your data. And realizing that there's already DR software, DR technologies out there, we keep asking ourselves, why aren't people using it? Well, the reason why is manifold. Number one is cost. If you've ever set up disaster recovery, you know that generally, I'm going to paint with a broad brush for a moment, you buy SAN one here, you buy the same exact SAN over here, and you buy some big fiber in the middle, and you replicate these things. really, really expensive. Number two, it's complex. You're going to hire some guys with PhDs. You're going to send some guys off to training. This is not something you're going to just, you know, set up one night. This is very complex. There's a lot of moving parts here. It's inflexible. SAN 1, SAN 2, guess what? They're the same SANs. You're not mixing and matching. What if you got branch offices? What if you got branch offices that literally just have standalone servers and you want to be able to put some of that info, you want to be able to back that up or replicate that back to your data center? One interesting conversation I will never forget was talking with an oil company. And an oil company, I started talking about this and they said, I didn't think they were going to be interested at all because I knew how much they'd spent on storage and SANs and all this. And they said, oh my gosh, this is the most important thing we've ever seen. And I said, you have to explain to me why. And they said, Jeff, look, we have oil rigs all over the world. And on each one of these oil rigs, we have between 10 to 20 servers, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little less. But we have data on that we would really love to be able to make sure is being replicated back to the data center site. And I said, yeah. And they said, look, we can't afford to put a SAN on every oil rig. Now, when an oil company tells you they don't have money to do something, I listen very carefully. So that inflexibility is a big piece of the puzzle. And finally, distance requirements. So if you're doing synchronous replication, you know, theoretically, the max is 150 kilometers, okay? But I've talked to a lot of people that do this, and pretty much nobody does 150 kilometers. They say, Jeff, no, more real world is 35 to 50. It's more of a metro type thing, all right? So if I want to go from, say, Redmond to Seattle, hey, that's great. But if I want to do Redmond to Amsterdam, that's not happening. If I want to do Redmond to London, that's not happening. So when we looked at this, we said, look, we want to find a solution that's broadly available to everyone. That's Hyper-V replica. Hyper-V replica is asynchronous, application-consistent virtual machine replication. It's all included into Windows Server. It's integrated with Hyper-V. So as you live migrate VMs around, this all just works. It's integrated with Active Directory. It's integrated with Group Policy. You can do planned movements. You can do unplanned movements. You can do test failover. This is integrated with volume shadow services. So, for example, if you're running SQL in the VM, and guess what? We take a replicated snapshot. We will call down into the VM and say, SQL, get yourself an app-consistent state. Properly quiesce everything. So this is tremendous. This is all built in. And I'm happy to say that when another big disaster did hit, Replica was there. Replica helped. This is Hurricane Sandy. This is in New Jersey. This is the coast before Sandy hit. Nice looking place. Definitely want to visit there. This is after Sandy hit. Doesn't even look remotely the same. Big parts of the freeway are gone. Well, this email hit my inbox the day after Sandy. Good morning. The hurricane hit our area badly. Many downed trees, even on my wife's car. Flooding and total power cuts were everywhere. We are very grateful that everyone is well. I now want to thank the Microsoft 2012 server team for giving businesses the new replica feature. Two of our clients, both cannot be without their IT infrastructure, were flooded entirely and might take 2 weeks to get back into their businesses. At 7 p.m. last night, we failed over their entire domains at the replica site and then been able to continue their daily business with zero interruption. Windows Server 2012 saved their business. I'm thrilled by that. People, please, we put this feature in there for you. Please use it. It's proven. We're doing this every day. We're thrilled by this. And then honestly, the uptake after 2012 for Replica was huge. And we listened very carefully. And for R2, we made sure that we met and hit all of your top needs. One of the biggest ones was, Jeff, I really want to be able to configure the replication time. In 2012, we replicated every 5 minutes. And the reason why we chose that time, it's kind of a sweet spot. We were going after commercial broadband. I've had folks replicate VMs between their homes over a cable modem. Okay? If you want, you know, fiber solutions, those already exist. Go out there, you can spend lots of money for those already. They exist already today. We want commercially broadband. So what we did was we defaulted to 5 minutes. But for folks that have really big pipes, we now have an option to go down to 30 seconds. And so we actually find a lot of people using that because broadband is getting much more readily available. There's still plenty of places, though, where networking is an issue. For example, in Africa, we got a lot of people telling us, look, We got really bad networks, and in fact, our network connectivity can be over satellite. So we need a lot more play in the replica. Give us something else. We went all the way up to 15 minutes for that. Another request was our service provider partners wanted to be able to offer replica as a solution for their service provider offerings. And we said, fantastic, that's exactly why we put this in there. If a small company doesn't have a secondary site to replicate to, wouldn't it be great if you could go to your local cloud service provider and replicate up to his cloud? Fantastic. But the service providers came back to us and they said, we love that. There's one problem, Jeff. We really want to be able to replicate to our secondary site as well. So we need another hop. So that's what we added. We added this extended replication. We added a whole second hop. So a customer can replicate to a service provider, and that service provider can still use replica to replicate to a secondary site on their own. Done. In the box. Already there. Finally, we get to the big one. And the big one was, Jeff, replica's awesome. There's a bunch of things we like about it. Number one is the ease of use. I literally right-click on a VM, walk through a wizard, and a couple steps, I'm done. A couple lines in PowerShell, done. I can now replicate my VMs. I'm sleeping so much better at night. This is awesome because it's so much easier to use. But here's the thing, Jeff. I got an office in Seattle. I got an office in LA. I've got an office in New York. I got an office in Miami. I got an office in Amsterdam. I've got an office in Paris. And what I really would like to do is go to one console and see it all. Can I do that? Well, you know what? We hear you loud and clear. Oh, but the other thing was, Jeff, by the way, this has to be easy. See, that's the whole beauty of replica. You made it so easy. If I have to do a whole bunch of things at every single site, that's going to be really painful. I really would like this to be able to log into a console, have it already there, and be able to manage it all remotely. That's exactly what we delivered in the Azure Hyper-V Recovery Manager. With the Azure Hyper-V Recovery Manager, I literally log into Azure, and it's there. And in fact, let's take a quick peek. Now remember before I showed you Azure Pack? You can see it's a little bit different. This is Azure. This is real Azure. And you can see, yes, lo and behold, there are so many services that, yes, there's a scroll bar. And like I mentioned before, when Azure was first launched many years ago, there were only a few services up there. Over time, we've added more and more and more. And our commitment, again, with the Azure Pack is to deliver more of these services so that you can deploy these in your own private clouds. Now, I showed this a minute to you ago, but just to show you that consistency again, let me go back in here and let me go and create a new virtual machine. Gosh, looks just like what I was doing with the Azure Pack. And in fact, here you can see I've got a whole bunch of images already residing, waiting for me up in Azure. So Microsoft, we already post a whole bunch of our own images. So if you want to go and get, and there's Windows Server Data Center, you want the Essentials experience, you want 2012, you want 2008 R2, awesome, go right ahead, it's all waiting for you. How about some SharePoint? Yep, that's sitting right up here as well. How about SQL, BizTalk? What's this? Ubuntu, CentOS, SUSE, Oracle's even up there. Hey, anybody working with Puppet or Chef, guess what? Puppet Images is up there. We're working very closely with both Puppet and Chef in terms of orchestration and automation as well. So these images are already available here, but the point again I want to make is that consistency, that symmetry, that's something we're delivering here. You saw the Azure Pack, and you can see it's consistent with what we're doing in Azure. So in terms of Recovery Manager, one of the things I really want to point is, so look at Recovery Services, and I've got Fabricam, and I've got the virtual machines that I'm protecting. One of the things I want to highlight here is the recovery plan. Because the recovery plan is really one of the key components to disaster recovery. In the case of a disaster, what actually happens? Well, usually some guy gets on a phone and you have to make a decision because you're not entirely sure what the situation is. If it's a case where, you know what, a fire burned down Site 1, all right, Site 1's not coming back anytime soon. Let's go ahead and fail over to Site 2. But what if Site 1's still up and running, but you've just had someone run a jackhammer through the network cable? And you know what? We think it'll be fixed in a couple of hours. Do I really want to fail it over? Maybe not. All right. So the recovery plan allows me to configure and determine what that recovery plan looks like. Because I don't necessarily want all my VMs to start at the same time. you know, my identity, authorization, my Active Directory, that's going to come up first. Then probably my SQL servers. Then additional things are going to come up over time. So this allows you to very easily create that recovery plan and even drop in things like scripts. So for example, maybe I want to call out to my orchestration engine, my data center automation to do something specific, to fire up something else in another system elsewhere. Maybe I want to actually trigger a manual action, which is after I get to step four, I get an alert comes that says, hey, you know what, call Bill in building six and have him flip the switches, the red and blue switches. So it's very customizable, it's very easy to use, and those are all key capabilities built in the Recovery Manager. So I urge you to take a look at Recovery Manager if it's something you haven't seen already. It allows you to easily create recovery plans. The other thing to point out is because it's configurable via browser, it works on any device. You can do this on your laptop, your tablet, your Surface, your iPhone, your iPad, even a phone, because it's literally a web browser. So again, mobility and cloud come together. So we've talked about a number of things, and I know this is going to be an awesome week, and I urge you to take advantage. Take a look at, really good look at all of the sessions out there. You can see our focus on mobility. You can see our focus on cloud. At the same time, tell us, what is it you want to see more of? How can we help you take it to the next level? At the end of the day, I know there's a lot of people talking to you about cloud. And honestly, we can spend hours and days arguing about this feature there. The thing I want to leave you with is this picture. At the end of the day, if you say, you know what, I'm sick and tired of Jeff telling me about this cloud OS, about public, private, and service providers, because if you tell me that, it means if you're actually sick of hearing it, it means the message has gotten through. We think about this very holistically. Quite honestly, we want to give you the cloud whenever and wherever it makes business sense for you. Thank you very, very much. Have a wonderful week right here at Tech Days. Thank you.